This is Movie Hopping for someday December 30th, maybe 29th. I don't fucking know. It's the end of December 2017. We're squeezing in another podcast, Adam Hall, before the new year.
Squeezing it right out of our asshole.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and watch some dolphins fuck?
I don't think I've ever actually sang that on New Year's ever.
Neither have I.
Not once have
you're
I
really
ever done
gay
that.
If you sing. Sorry, not to be too homophobic, but you're a faggot if you sing that stupid song on New Year's.
You sound like Arlie Ermey in Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
I have no issue. I don't discriminate, so I have no problems with him. Then he says the N-word.
Right.
He says faggots. He says all these racial slurs.
All the horrible slurs, exactly right. I have no problem with any of them. Yeah. On Christmas Day, somebody put on Facebook, "Happy birthday to Jesus." And they just said, you know, with Arlie Emery singing, "Happy birthday to you." And then at the end goes, "God has a hard on for Marines because we kill." I was dying.
That is some funny shit every time I see that.
What a great performance.
It is.
What a tremendous performance. And I will say, racism, this is a weird thought, racism and crudeness and evil and just brashness on screen, I find endlessly entertaining. Mm. Which segues well into the film that we're talking about today, The Shape of Water, by Guillermo del Toro, visionary behind Pan's Labyrinth, Little Prince, right?
I don't know. He did Kronos.
Kronos.
The Devil's Backbone.
Sure.
Blade 2.
Blade 2.
Hellboy.
Hellboy 2.
Hellboy 2.
And of course.
Pan's Labyrinth.
And of course.
Crimson Tide.
Wait for it. Wait for it.
Crimson Peak.
Pacific
Crimson Rim.
Tide. Pacific Rim! Prequel to Pacific Rim Uprising. Pacific Rim.
I love Pacific Rim.
I do too.
I love Pacific Rim.
It's a masterpiece. It could be my it's not my favorite Guillermo movie, but it's like one of my three favorite Guillermo movies.
Yeah,
I haven't seen that many Guillermo movies, I will say.
I love Guillermo del Toro. I find the Hellboy movies very underrated. I'm a big fan of those.
I feel like I've only seen one Hellboy movie.
Okay.
But I'm not even sure I did. But I feel like at some point I saw a Hellboy movie.
How can you not see Hellboy just for Ron Perlman alone?
I do
wonderful.
How do you feel about the Hellboy reboot that's coming up?
With David Harbour in it?
Yeah.
It's directed by, I think the guy's name is Neil Marshall, and he made a couple of very good films. Two that I love. I mean, he made Dog Soldiers, which is wonderful. And then he made a movie that's a horror masterpiece called The Descent, which is an absolute favorite of mine. So I'm pretty excited, actually. It's going to be rated R, so, you know.
Okay. And the original Hellboys were not rated R, right?
No.
They were PG-13.
No. But they could have easily been rated R if they wanted to be.
Right. The thing with Guillermo is he's not necessarily a gory or explicit filmmaker, but his concepts and creatures and set design are so creepy, like you want to keep your kids away from it.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
He's got quite the imagination. He's one of those guys that the Coen brothers are like, yeah, we could never make a film like that, dude.
It's true. No, he has this vision that is, and I do love me some creature features.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love when, like, someone goes crazy with monsters. Like, I'm not a big horror guy, but in Guillermo's case, like, Pan's Labyrinth, I just find brilliant. I just think, like, how do you think of a guy with hands with eyeballs on them?
It's great.
Oh, my God. And it's so horrifying. And the way that Pan's Labyrinth switches from reality to this majestical world, and you're not exactly sure which one is more horrifying. Mm-hmm. You go back and forth, and you realize that the horror in real life is just as horrible as the horror in your nightmares. Incredible stuff. I love me some Pan's Labyrinth.
It's a beautiful film.
Yeah.
I love it.
It really is. So Guillermo is an incredible filmmaker, and he has a movie that came out this year called The Shape of Water. It's getting a lot of award buzz, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about that for the next hour. But first, Adam.
What's up?
You want to catch up on what we've been watching?
Sure.
Let's do that. What have you been watching?
What have I been watching? I finally sat down and watched all of Being John Malkovich.
Ooh!
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah. So you'd never seen it?
I loved it. I loved it. I loved it.
Octavia Spencer's in that movie, isn't she? Like, for like 2 seconds? Isn't she in the elevator?
Yeah.
She helps him, like, get into, like, the little crevice?
Yeah, that's right. She is. I thought is brilliant and makes me appreciate Get Out a little bit more.
What?
Because those they're connected. They're officially connected.
Explain.
Because of the whole premise around is built around the idea of jumping into another person's body and, you know, kind of living their life, and in being John Malkovich, it's old people trying to live through forever by occupying the body of, you know, John Malkovich and, you know, a line of other people in history.
Yeah.
And it's basically the same thing in Get Out, except, you know, it's old people occupying the bodies of various black people.
Right.
And it was a fan theory at first, and then Jordan Peele got a hold of it, and then Spike Jonze got a hold of it, and then they both came together like, we can make this true, right? And
right.
They're just like, it's too perfect. And they're like, yeah, go ahead.
So is it actually true, or it's just like in hindsight?
I think it's like one of those Star Wars things where it's like the fans come up with it, and then somewhere down the line, they pick it up, and they're like, you know, this is too good. It's officially canon.
Right.
It's kind of like that.
Okay.
So I guess officially, according to the creators of Being John Malkovich and Get Out, those movies are connected.
Right.
At least spiritually.
Okay. But the mechanisms for which these people inhabit the bodies of someone else are not even close to the same in these two movies. One is a magical portal in an office building, and the other is a very morbid operational procedure done by Bradley Whitford at his estate in the middle of the woods.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, very different, but okay.
Yeah.
Tomato, tomato,
it's
I guess.
It's a precursor to the portal, I guess.
Yeah. Really good Cameron Diaz performance.
Really good, but I'm not a huge John Cusack fan, but I kind of loved him in this.
Yeah, also in the era where John Cusack wasn't making horrible choices. There was like a sweet spot right in the middle, like the High Fidelity, Being John Malkovich, and can I name a third? I'm not sure I can. But that dude is not a very good actor, but he made some pretty good choices.
Early on in his career.
Early on in his career.
Yeah, yeah.
And was in a really good movie about the Beach Boys called Love and Mercy.
Oh, I heard that was pretty
good. Brian Wilson flick.
I heard that was good.
Yeah, that's with Paul Dano and him playing two versions of Brian Wilson.
Okay.
And, again, very good movie, a good choice for John Cusack. However, Paul Dano outshines him in every way possible.
Paul Dano's the man.
Yeah. Paul Dano is just incredible and just becomes Brian Wilson, and John Cusack's just like, yo, you're playing with the big boys. What are you doing here?
Paul Dano is one of those people where it's like, I don't actually know what his personality is.
Right.
Because he's just so different every time I see him on screen. I'm convinced he's like a psychopath.
He's a chameleon.
Yeah, basically.
Well, I'm sure he probably has no personality.
Probably.
That's the thing about actors, right?
Well, I guess.
It's like Daniel Day-Lewis is the most boring guy in the world.
Sure.
You wouldn't want to have a beer with Daniel Day-Lewis.
He's like a real... supposedly Ryan Gosling's the man.
I'm sure he is.
Yeah.
But Ryan Gosling, for as wonderful an actor as he is not like this method. Like, he doesn't go to that dark of a place that often.
Not necessarily, no.
Right.
Unless it's like maybe Blue Valentine or like Half Nelson, I guess.
Right.
Which
certainly.
Are both fantastic.
Even if he's making Drive... It's still like I get to be the action star. You know what I mean?
Yeah. In quotes.
Sure. I get to be the badass with a jacket that some boy in Connecticut owns.
Who would that be?
I don't know.
What kind
of
fag would wear that?
Just
shit.
Speculating. Just speculating.
Jesus, what an asshole.
What else you been watching?
What did I watch recently? I mean, I saw The Shape of Water.
I have one that we both watched.
What did we watch?
I know you because you brought this up to me. Jim and Andy.
Oh!
Colin.
Jim
the
and
Great
Andy.
Beyond.
We never talked about
featuring
this.
A contractually obligated mention of Tony Clifton or whatever the fuck that title is. Yo, fuck that movie.
I thought it was incredibly entertaining.
Were you really entertained?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Were you really?
Maybe not necessarily for the right reasons, but... I mean, it really makes you hate Jim Carrey.
That's the thing about it. So there's a line. This is a documentary that documents the behind-the-scenes antics of Jim Carrey when he shot the movie Man on the Moon about Andy Kaufman.
Mm.
And he contends in this documentary that he channeled the spirit of Andy Kaufman.
Literally.
Yes.
Channeled the spirit.
While making this film and stayed in character the entire time, not becoming Jim Carrey, or not being Jim Carrey, rather becoming Andy Kaufman for the duration of it. Here's what I found entertaining about it, and I'll list those things. Milos Forman not knowing how the hell to deal with this guy was endlessly amusing to me.
Oh, yeah.
Watching this Austrian, German, whatever he is, like old school dude. I made, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and now I got to deal with this asshole tormenting me for 3 weeks. I found that very funny.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
This wonderful director just kind of cracking a little bit.
Yes.
It's very interesting to see that, the authority figure just failing, even though Man on the Moon is not a bad film. So.
Really? You like Man on the Moon?
Yep.
I've never seen it.
It's a little... I don't know. Hmm. It's interesting.
Do you like Jim Carrey's performance in it?
I do like Jim
Carrey.
You do? Yep, I do, actually. It's really good.
But there's a line in the documentary where he goes, the studio didn't want me to release this footage because they were afraid I would look like an asshole.
No kidding.
And I thought to myself, well, I don't blame him.
Yeah.
I really don't blame him.
No fucking kidding.
Because he just seemed to sort of torment these people for no good reason. You know?
The idea was, you know, that's what Andy would have done, I guess.
But I'm not sure that's what Andy would have done.
I don't like to assume the motives of these people, but, you know, there's a limit, you know? They're human beings. I'm just like, what?
Right.
I don't know. I didn't buy it on the whole. Maybe to a certain extent I could see Andy Kaufman doing stuff like that, but, you know, at a certain point the joke stops.
There was a guy in the movie, some wrestler who I
Jerry Lawler.
Jerry Lawler, who I'm just not familiar with any of that stuff, but he was... evidently had a very public feud with Andy Kaufman in real life.
But it wasn't real.
Right, when Kaufman was a professional wrestler and it's sort of...
Kaufman being a professional
wrestler. Right, that was sort of his thing for like the last 10 years of his life, right? Or
no.
Five or whatever it was.
No. It was an antic of him going up and fighting women and saying sexist remarks to women. And then they'd come and beat him up. He was not a real wrestler at all.
I see. Well, okay.
It's just another comedy act.
All meta. All meta comedy.
Very meta. Yeah.
Right. But Jerry Lawler knew Andy very well. They, again, conspired to make this very public feud. And what he said during the filming of this movie, because he literally punched Jim Carrey in the face when they were on set together, he goes, yeah, Andy was never like this. Like, Andy was always very polite to me and would always call me Mr. Lawler and was always very sweet.
That's right.
You know? So that just makes me think, man, Jim Carrey is just using this as an excuse to be an asshole, as if, you know, under the guise of this being good art. And I just found myself very annoyed at the whole thing, and I just continued to cringe the entire documentary. I was not entertained that much.
Well, it was working on you, it sounds like, though.
I guess so.
That's the thing. Like, as unsettling as it is, I think that's kind of the point. That's kind of why I ended up sort of liking it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strange, and it does make you kind of resent Jim Carrey a bit, but it's a watch.
Okay.
It's a watch.
I also watched... I've been catching up on a number of films. I'm going to save some of them because I think they need to be discussed at the end of the year review we're doing very soon.
Okay.
So I'll save a couple of them for that. I watched I Love You, Daddy.
Okay.
Now, I might have viewed it through some questionable legal means. But, yo, the studio ain't letting me see it, so God damn it, I'm going to take to the streets.
Cool.
All right? If the government doesn't legalize, like, I gotta get my kicks somehow. You know what I'm saying?
I want to see this artist who masturbates in front of women.
Yeah, man. Just because Louis C.K. jerked off in front of a number of people, abusing his position of power and scarring women for the rest of their lives, doesn't mean that I can't enjoy my Woody Allen movie. Okay?
Oh, is that what it is?
It's basically that. So,
okay.
I Love You, Daddy's weird, man. It's really weird. And I don't know if it's going to crack my top 10. I haven't quite decided yet because I'm not sure what I think about it. Here's what I know. This movie needs to be seen by people.
Okay.
And I think if people see it and we talk about it, I feel like we're going to get somewhere productive.
Yeah. I'm not one of those assholes who's like, I don't want to see it because it's Louis C.K. No, I want to see it because it's Louis C.K.
Yes.
Is the thing.
It is a very gross movie. It is a movie that makes you question a lot of stuff and is very morally ambiguous and goes for it. And that's what I love about Louis, and what I'll continue to love about Louis, regardless of how often he works in Hollywood or not, is that this dude will take fucking chances, and he will smack you in the face with whatever really fucked up thought he's thinking. Mm-hmm. This movie talks about rape and pedophilia and sexuality in a very complicated way. Very, very, very complicated way. And it dances on that line quite a bit. And the sexual politics of this whole thing are very gross. Okay. And I think that's intentional. And not to say that he was, you know, advocating for this sort of behavior. But we're really confronted with interesting stuff in this movie. And it's too bad that I had to watch it on a torrent site in, like, really shitty 720 definition from a bootleg screener.
I suppose it's better than nothing.
I guess. That is true. Excellently crafted. Just, like, exquisitely crafted. Okay. Old Hollywood style, black and white. Man, the dude has really learned how to use the camera.
Cool.
Over whatever the last 10 years of being an independent filmmaker, I guess. But
not
this
not the hardest thing in the world to do.
Yeah. Well, all right then, Mr. No, all right, Kubrick.
I always say it, as far as like shot composition, you can learn shot composition quicker than like lighting. Lighting, yeah. you'll never master lighting for as long as you live, but shot composition you can pick up.
Okay. Anyway, this movie was very well shot and terrifically acted because this guy was able to attract incredible talent to these movies. John Malkovich is in this one. He plays a Woody Allen type character that gets into a, I guess, relationship with Louis's daughter, Chloe Grace Moretz, who is 17 years old. And they take up sort of a weird friendship, and the complication is that John Malkovich is a accomplished filmmaker that Louis's character looks up to and admires, and is a bit of a hero to him. And sort of the weird dynamics of that, and the weird thing about power and about age and what all of it means. It is a very complicated movie, and I understand, regardless of the baggage that Louis brought into it, would still be a very complicated and controversial movie that might have gotten not as much backlash as there is now, but certainly a decent amount of backlash. But again, is a movie that I think deserves to be watched and should be talked about, and it's too bad we're never going to be able to talk about it.
All right.
But there you go.
I gave it a look.
I watched that one. Also, you know what? I'll save the rest. Oh, I watched a movie called The Lost City Z.
Oh yeah, how was that?
A little slow.
Okay.
A little slow. And I find Charlie Hunnam to just be a charisma black hole.
Yeah, maybe. You might be right about that.
He nearly killed Pacific Rim for me.
Okay.
And I love Pacific Rim. But yeah. Man, oh man, is he a flawed leading man.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, and he was sort of flawed here. It's a true story about an explorer that is looking at to find a lost city that
of
Native Americans in, in South America, I want to say. Mm-hmm. The details are lost on me because I was kind of falling asleep.
Okay.
No, a well-shot movie. Robert Pattinson plays his, like, sidekick. And Robert Pattinson is quietly having, like, an incredible year.
Yeah, I haven't seen Good Time, but...
So I also watch Good Time, and we'll talk about that a little bit later.
I'm more
in
interested in Good Time than anything else, really.
Oh, will we talk about Good... Can you see Good Time between now and the end of the year show?
Yeah.
Figure out a way to do it. Mm-hmm. It's also available through questionable means online.
Okay. I'll see Good Time.
If you so choose. Yo. Good Time? Mm-hmm. You want to know something about Good Time?
What?
It's a good time.
Oh, yeah?
It's a really good...
That's not what I heard. I heard it was a good movie. I didn't hear it was a good time.
Oh, well, for some people. But for these very specific tastes, oh, did it play all my strings, baby? No. Did it? It just got there.
It's a movie about brothers, so it'll probably get me pretty good.
Robert Pattinson's incredible in it.
Yeah, I hear.
Real Michael Mann vibes, like real like Collateral vibes.
Okay.
Like incredible color palette, a really good New York movie. It takes place all in one night, really well shot. And for an indie flick starring Robert Pattinson, like that's about as good as you can get.
They don't overuse close-ups on the face, do they?
No, I don't, not really.
Okay.
Yeah, not really.
A lot of indie films do that, and it really fucking annoys me. That's why I really enjoyed the Macon Blair and Jeremy Saulnier films, because they're like, hey, we're going to make a mature set of films.
Right. Wow, I wouldn't call them mature necessarily.
I would, in they're genre films that, to me, feel mature in regards to their filmmaking style.
They're also very violent.
That's fine.
They're also, like childishly violent.
I don't know. Blue Ruins, I wouldn't say, call that childish violence.
I remember I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, a guy's hand getting shot off.
That's more, well, that's deliberately more comedic, but I feel Jeremy Saulnier has a better grasp on that stuff anyway.
I love Jeremy Saulnier, don't get me wrong, but yeah. No, Good Time, it is a gritty Michael Mann movie with a real sense of place and a really well-paced and entertaining, but also dark.
All right.
Tremendous.
Okay.
Loved Good Time. Talk about that at the end of the year.
All right.
Okay?
Got to see Good
Time. Let's talk about Shape of Water, shall we?
Yeah.
Hit me with your Shape of Water takes, because I don't want to take
Why do I have to go first?
Because the audience is not going to appreciate what I'm going to say about The Shape of Water. That's why.
You didn't like The Shape of Water.
I didn't.
You didn't like The Shape of Water?
I didn't like it.
Why didn't you like it?
Okay, here's why it's not fair.
Okay.
I saw the trailer for Shape of Water.
Okay.
We saw a lot of movies together this year.
Yeah.
We
saw a few. Couple.
We did. And Shape of Water was playing in front of all of those movies, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the trailer, I might have been with you the first time, I'm not 100% sure.
Mm.
I turned to you and, said, fish fucking, not really my thing. Just like, not really my cup of tea. No matter how whimsical, no matter how imaginative, no matter if Guillermo is doing it or not, like, this premise is going to take a lot to get me there. It's really going to take a lot. And I understand that people are lauding this movie and that people appreciate the audaciousness of it. And I'm sure you did. And I'm sure we'll talk about all of those things. But this movie, in a certain sense, was kind of predestined to fail because it's just not a Nico movie.
Now, no.
That being said, I found it severely flawed on its premise, and I will try my absolute best while we dissect this to look at it objectively and to actually measure up to whatever its ambitions were.
Okay.
So, with that being said, I'm going to get ranty in a second. What did you think?
Oh, you're going to get ranty in a second.
Yeah, I'm going to get ranty.
I kind of love this movie.
You do?
Yeah. No, It's interesting because there's nothing spectacular. Again, it's one of those movies where the premise is ridiculous. There's nothing spectacular about its story. It's essentially Beauty and the Beast meets Free Willy. That's The Shape of Water.
Okay.
But again, it's one of those instances where I don't really care if I've seen those stories before, as long as I presented with a way of telling it that feels unique to me, and it's its own voice that's special. And I think it's a beautifully made film that has more heart than most movies that have come out this year. And the performances are wonderful, and I don't think there's really a weak link in it. Sally Hawkins is wonderful, and Doug Jones is incredible, and Michael Shannon is, how could you not like Michael Shannon? He's a crazy motherfucker.
Doug Jones is who?
The Aquaman, Fishman thing.
You thought he was incredible?
Yeah, I love Doug Jones and everything he does.
What did you find particularly incredible about this performance?
I just like any physical monster performance that just sells me that this creature is there is just perfect to me. That's why I'm a big fan of his performance in Pan's Labyrinth is incredible.
Okay.
And any of his performances as Abe Sapien is great. And then just going back to other monster movies like Kevin Peter Hall's The Predator, it's just little things. It's physicality in an actor is something that's very rare. It's something that they're scared of because no actor knows how to do it.
Right.
Actors rely a lot on dialogue,
uh-huh.
which is why when I see an actor actually say, hey, I'm going to use all my body to give a performance, literally telling everything you need to know about me visually, that's just – to me, that's incredibly impressive. And it's very hard to do. And like I said, it's something actors are terrified of.
So I found this creature – I'm sorry, to be very unconvincing.
Oh, really?
I really did. Wow. I found it to be very unconvincing. First of all, I didn't love the design of it. I thought the design of it was a bit forgettable.
Ooh.
I did.
Why?
I really did. Because I don't think the CGI was very good.
What do you mean?
I didn't like the CGI. I just thought it looked fake to me. It really looked like a guy in a costume.
What's CGI? What are you talking about?
That was completely costumed?
Yeah.
There wasn't any CGI utilized at all?
No, other than the lights when he lights up. Yeah, that's all.
That was all a costume?
Yeah.
Okay, no wonder it looked fake. I guess. I assume there was some element of CGI.
The CGI looked fake to me. The literal CGI looked like CGI to me. Here's the problem, dude. Like, you can say that looks like a costume, but I'm looking at that as like, yeah, that's a real thing. It's actually there. That's nice. That's nice. It's palpable to me.
Okay.
And there's a presence there. It's not like the clone troopers in fucking Star Wars.
No, I understand. I don't know. I found it to be I don't know. Maybe this was just the production design or the makeup or whatever it was. I don't know. I was taken out of it every time I saw that thing. I was not I was not struck with any sense of wonder when I looked at it. And that's what I kind of need to get when I see a creature, is I need to think, whoa, like. That's what a person can draw up. Pan's Labyrinth is full of creatures like that.
Oh yeah,
you know, and I didn't feel like this particular character was. I mean, that's the best they can do. I don't know.
I thought it was great.
Okay, fair enough. And I also didn't find his performance strike me as anything particularly magnificent. I feel like if you put Andy Serkis in that thing, it is like 20 times the performance.
Well, Andy Serkis is another example of what I'm talking about.
Sure.
Though, where, again, like, he just knows how to make a physical character work.
Right.
And I'm sorry, actors, but don't be scared to do that. That's, again, it's another reason why I like Fury Road so much, is because you did it all with your body, mm-hmm. and that's amazing to me.
What did you think of that character, though, of the fish man?
I don't know.
I feel like I'm kidding when I say fish man, but I am
He's a
struck,
fish man.
I'm struck every time by just the absurdity of the fact that this is a love story with a fish man in it. I thought his character was a bit one dimensional, didn't you think?
What do you mean?
Well, I don't know. Like, what was particularly moving about that performance? What was it about, besides the fact that he was like a pet, basically?
Well, the point of the movie is that it's presented like a pet at first, right?
Mm-hmm.
You see this thing, and it's a thing to you. And by the end of the movie, you're like, this is a being.
Right.
That's sort of the development of his character. I mean, it's hard to you know, make this person – to develop him in the way that maybe Gollum's developed.
Right.
But again, that's also they have like three movies to do that, and it's a little bit different. But,
so why are we led to believe that he is a real thing by the end of it? What attributes did you see?
Well, it's his relationship with Sally Hawkins.
Yeah, but that's in her performance, not necessarily in his performance.
I disagree.
Okay. Explain.
I mean, just any of the scenes where they're together and just the way he interacts with her. I mean, I was very carefully watching him and just being like, how is he going to, you know, react to her when she does this movement, or how is he going to react when she meets him in the theater or whatever. It's just, it's very subtle and meticulous, and anything from just the way he moves his hands or just the way he slowly moves his body or adjusts to look at her, I just found it captivating.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't feel that way. And this is my larger flaw with the movie.
Okay.
And I'm going to view it in a vacuum and try to look at this objectively. I thought their relationship was a bit underdeveloped and flat. I really did. I didn't buy their relationship, and I didn't care about it by the end of it.
Okay, I can understand that, actually.
And that is a big flaw, because the movie is predicated on their relationship.
The only issue I'm there with you to a certain extent. I think they rushed into their relationship very quickly when she's first discovering him.
Mm-hmm.
They jump into that to me a little quickly. I would have had at least one more scene with them together, you know, developing that relationship a little bit more, but they jump pretty quickly to her giving him eggs and then her dancing with him. And I was just kind of like, well, that was a pretty large gap, and I know where this is going to go afterwards. So, and I know you're not going to have many more scenes of this, so, you know, it would have been like perfect if you had at least one more moment with them doing just one thing together. I don't care what it is, just do that. But after that, though, I mean, all the scenes with them in their apartment, including the sex scene, I was there for it.
I know you were.
I
know you were there for it. I just didn't. If you're going to give me something that audacious, and it was bold risk, and You know, I never quite thought of Beauty and the Beast as that. I never considered, oh, yeah, there's a big monster dick involved in this situation.
Yes.
You know, they went there and I'm okay with them going there, but you got to make me buy it. And I really did not buy why she was so in love with this thing more than the love that you would necessarily have for a house pet. You know, like what?
I believed it.
Okay.
I guess. But again, this is another one of those movies where story is not necessarily on my mind. This is a movie that reminds me, it's nothing like Vertigo or Blade Runner, but it reminds me of how I experienced something like Vertigo or Blade Runner.
Which is what? Its vibe?
No. Vertigo and Blade Runner are two instances where the story is either ludicrous or sort of secondary. Uh-huh. It's less about focusing on the story necessarily as it is, just sitting down and letting the film work for you visually.
Uh-huh.
I have a tendency to be very fond of movies that where I can just be like, you know, I don't know if I necessarily buy the premise, but just as an emotional visual experience and what this film is trying to tell me in those regards, it's just very, very, very moving to me.
I guess I don't necessarily care about plot that much either here, and because it's not a very plot-heavy movie.
No.
But in terms of an emotional experience, you need to buy the relationship between these characters.
I mean,
it's a romance. That's what every romance relies on. And what I didn't see, and I didn't know where they made this leap, is why this mute woman who went through some sort of trauma in her life would find solace in this creature and not anybody else. Like, what makes this thing special besides the fact that he's just an outcast? Like, if all you're going to tell me is, you know, people don't get me and people don't get him, so we're good together. That's a little flat for me. It really is flat. And beyond the one scene that Sally Hawkins had with Richard Jenkins in the apartment where she was explaining all this in a very over-the-top, beat-you-over-the-head way, I don't know. Give me a little more nuance. I don't know, man. I found that insufficient. I really didn't. I thought the character work here for a premise that is already I am predisposed not to like – it got a little more eye-rolly for me.
I guess the reason it worked for me ultimately is because of the characters that these are. Because her explaining that is fine. I mean, again, it's not the worst exposition scene I've ever seen because it's a mixture of talking and visual cues, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it's the fact that both of these characters are so, I guess, fundamentally connected in the way that they can really only communicate through those just, you know, physical means that sort of made it a little more distinct and unique and special. So it does kind of make sense to me why they might be able to connect, at least on that level. And also the fact that it's a fucking fishman, and how could you not be fascinated by a fucking fishman?
No, you can be fascinated by him, fine. Falling in love with him is a little different.
Yes.
And I'm not, like, Sally Hawkins does have relationships in her life. I mean, I understand Richard Jenkins is a gay man, and Octavia Spencer is a woman and her coworker, so it's not necessarily romantic relationships. But we have established that she can have human connections. You know, it's not like these connections are lacking in her life, so... to be honest with you, I was way more moved by the connection that she had with Richard Jenkins' character.
Oh, yeah.
I was far more moved by that, and I bought that a lot more, and I cared about that relationship.
I will almost agree with you that that's far more well-developed.
Right.
I'm not saying I don't like the fishman romance, but the connection between those two characters is handled a little bit better. I'll agree with
you
there.
But my point is, if you're going to go there, and to a point where literally this fishman and this mute woman – have sex and she gets gills by the end of it, and which, oh my God, was I rolling my eyes so hard. Like, I was seeing the in every little wrinkle on my brain. That's how much I was rolling my eyes during that scene. They do live happily ever after together. If you're gonna make that choice and you're gonna give me the Beauty and the Beast shit, that's the relationship that needs to get developed, and you cannot yada yada through that.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't. And I had a real problem with that, and that made what was an already absurd premise even more absurd. That being said, I agree with you. The performances were remarkable. Octavia Spencer's solid in everything. Richard Jenkins is even more solid in everything. He is just one of our finest character actors ever. This guy is so good. And Sally Hawkins was solid. But
you want my feelings towards, like, I guess any, like, random negatives, because I guess my issues with this film, they just sort of pop up.
Yeah,
you know, I don't think there's any fundamental problems with this movie, if I'm being totally honest.
Okay.
I really don't. But if like every once in a while the movie would do something, like even for its premise I was just like, why did you react that way, character? Right. Like the way Octavia Spencer reacts to Sally Hawkins saying I had sex with this fish man.
Yes.
It's just like, oh no way, I can't believe you did that. I'm just like,
yeah, he's got a penis.
What?
And then they're illustrating how exactly the penis came out of it.
I'm just like, sorry, but you didn't set up properly that Octavia Spencer was okay with this.
Right.
That's my issue. That's issue.
Everybody just buys into this fairly easily. Like Richard Jenkins just like, yeah, let's break into this government institution.
That's issue number
Mermaid one. Man,
yes.
Huh?
Yes.
Sounds fascinating.
Michael Shannon's candy scene is the most over-the-top thing I've ever seen. It's just
okay.
I don't know what to do with that.
So stop right there. Stop right there.
Yes.
The only thing. The only thing that kept me engaged in this movie. And by engaged meaning I did not walk out of the theater just to take a breath and how absurd and whimsical this whole thing was. Mm-hmm. Was Michael Shannon in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
This is seriously one of my favorite performances of the year. I loved that character so much. I loved every choice that he made. I loved the candy. I loved how over the top it was. I love when he ripped his fingers out of his sockets. I love how he was at home with his wife. That really weird, awkward sex scene where he's telling her to be quiet and he puts the bloody hand over her mouth. How much he hates his life and hates his job. Oh my God, it was great. It was how rapey he got with Sally Hawkins. This guy was so evil and so comically evil.
Yeah.
In the way that a lot of movie villains don't really get these days. Like, I don't know. We're in a weird place with cinema villains now where they are very
bad.
Yeah, well, they're very bad. But they're not bad in a fun way. They're just bad in a boring way. Mm-hmm. And I think he was bad in a fun way. Like, it was just over the top and ridiculous, but he was having a great time with it. And we need to have more fun with our evil.
Yes, I
right?
agree.
So I adored his performance, and I loved the candy, and I did love that. I loved how quietly racist he was the entire time. I was laughing so hard.
That was good stuff. That was really, really good stuff.
Michael Shannon was so good in this. I loved it. I absolutely loved him.
Yep.
So
I agree.
Yeah. The candy scene, I'm in. Stuhlberg makes a performance.
Oh, Stuhlberg's wonderful in literally everything he's in.
He's so good in everything.
Yes.
He's having quite the year, too.
Yes. Yeah. He should be in just about every film that ever gets made.
Fargo season 3.
Oh, yeah. He's in Fargo season 3. Of course he is.
He's tremendous in Fargo season 3. Yeah. He's in The Post coming up.
Yeah.
Which everybody is in, but he makes a little appearance in that.
I'm not excited for that.
I'm excited just because, like, grandparents need movies too. You know, grandma needs to go be excited.
You're already a grandpa, Nico.
I'm just saying. Oh, he's in Call Me By Your Name. Okay. He was in Doctor Strange last year. That's right.
He was? Oh, boy.
He's popping up all over the place, that Stuhlberg.
Serious Man really launched him, didn't it?
It did.
Yeah.
And he's tremendous in that too.
That's incredible film.
Yeah, but he has a fun little performance, even though his character was not really given much to do. But he's very good. And I will say, to be very fair, that the production design in this, as the production design always is in a Guillermo film, I didn't like Crimson Peak all that much.
I didn't see Crimson Peak.
But my Lord, is that a wonderfully built movie. That their sense of place and the color palette and just the inventiveness of the locations is incredible. And I will say that this movie had a look.
Yep.
You know, you can never say that a Guillermo movie doesn't have a look, and this one really did take you to a time and place.
Yep.
You know?
I agree. It's visually unforgettable. I loved it.
It's true.
I really do love it. And again, that's, to me, with movies that are this ridiculous, that's almost more important than anything. It's just how Guillermo chooses to traverse us through this visually striking story, and, you know, how we respond to it. It's weird. I'm speaking as like the film nerd, film
guy. You don't say.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, the older I've gotten, the more I'm just like, yeah, you know, movies like that just speak to me more than something like, I don't know, like the Meyerowitz stories, if I'm being totally honest.
Why? Explain why. Let's try to break this down. I love psychologically analyzing you.
It's
my favorite thing.
Meyerowitz Stories is like effective in almost overly literal sense, I guess. I don't
Too
know.
Real?
Nah, it's I guess it comes back to that idea where it's like logic is dull, which I completely agree 100%, especially with movies,
mm-hmm.
where it's like if you sometimes stick too close to reality, it can become less interesting. Unless you're telling a story that is just that heartbreaking and complicated, like fucking Manchester by the Sea, right. You got to be careful with what stories you choose to tell.
Yeah.
And in the case of the Meyerowitz Stories, I thought it was good. It's fine, but I can't imagine revisiting it and being like, yeah, I'm having a great time, you know? It's not visually remarkable in any way. It's not something that I'm going to other than Pagina Man.
Now
that I have to admit, that was pretty great.
As a film nerd, you were probably dying laughing during
I'm just
that,
like,
right?
I couldn't tell if Noah Baumbach was in love with those film students or satirizing them.
No, definitely satirizing.
He better have been satirizing.
Definitely satirizing.
He seemed to sympathize with the girl a lot, but I was like...
Certainly sympathizing, no question.
Yeah.
But all I know is when I went to Emerson College for 1 year, my freshman year, like I knew maybe 30 girls like that.
Yep.
They all
My movie's to... not good unless I show my tits and I'm fucking. It's like...
What? I'm a feminist!
I'm just like, what?
It is so ridiculous. But beyond that, I guess it's not visually striking. I don't know. I'm a huge fan of mumblecore shit, man. I think in the last year or whatever, I have just I've gone into like this deep dive with the mumblecore movies. And
have you seen Damien Chazelle's first movie?
No, I haven't. That's the Lady on the Park Bench or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, whatever it's called.
I don't think you'll like it.
I won't. But that's a musical, right?
It's sort of it's a musical, but it feels like an attempt at a musical.
Okay.
You know?
Because I'm talking mumblecore just straight up like...
Yeah, no, it's like mumblecore the musical though, really.
Okay.
There's just no structure in that movie whatsoever. It's very... There's no hardly any plot or there's barely a story. It's just two characters. Every once in a while we jump back to them just to see what they're doing.
Yeah.
That's really all it is.
I mean, I just love a minimalist... And not in every case. Like, I love Dunkirk as much as the next guy. But I find something really compelling about limits in storytelling and in art. I feel like all great art comes from limits.
Yep.
And sometimes when you take away as many tools in the tool chest as you can and see what you're left with, I find it really cool. So like in the case of a mumblecore movie, let's strip away interesting aesthetic choices. Let's strip away any semblance of a story. And let's just put actors with dialogue in rooms together and see what happens. And I find that really interesting.
Yes.
You know?
Dialogue's nice. It doesn't really stick with me through the ages always unless...
I'm a dialogue guy.
That's the thing.
I love me some dialogue.
I haven't seen The Red Turtle, but I could take The Red Turtle and be happy with that for years.
Right. No, I get you.
I'm a film lover in like the purest sense, and not to say that I have any issue with dialogue heavy films, because I really don't. Because the Before trilogy, all three of them are three of my favorite films ever.
Mm-hmm.
But those are even more unique, and what they're doing is even more interesting and complicated, and it presents these themes of love in ways that I've never seen before, it illustrates it in a way in film that I've never seen before, and it's just beautiful to experience those characters or live with them for 2 hours.
Yeah. No, I find dialogue interesting only in those specific instances where, again, the director does not have much of a vision, right? So if the director just sort of hangs back and says this is the writer's medium or whatever, that's why, like, good writing is so important in comedy and on television, right? If you're making a sitcom, it has to be a writer's medium because that's where all the comedy comes from. So in instances like that, this dude, I just looked up his name here, Joe Swanberg, who did that movie Win It All this year, that was on Netflix, and he did a couple other movies called he made a movie called Drinking Buddies. I don't know if you saw that. But he just essentially makes these movies with no plot and just a lot of talking. what I love about those types of things is we're just going to hang back and we're going to let all the writing do all of the work, and sort of like a playwright would do. And we just happen to be filming it, but we might not be filming it. This is just something that you could be looking at. I really love that. I really, really love that. And those are the movies that I'm drawn to.
Yes.
You know? Shape of Water, I didn't necessarily feel that way, because I feel like if you take away the interesting visual choices, you're not really left with much.
Yeah. I don't fully agree with that, though. That's the thing.
Okay, that's fair.
But no, and again, I don't even feel like I have to defend myself, because like I keep saying, I'm not opposed to that stuff.
Right.
It's just like, to me, you have to have a fairly interesting story to hang it on, and you have to be able to tell that well with the limits you're working with. And sometimes movies get that very well. Sometimes movies are over-reliant on a script, like in the case of Steve Jobs.
Yeah. What
now,
about Steve Jobs?
I like Steve.
Careful.
I like Steve Jobs.
Okay.
But I've never found, like, every drama scene feels exactly the same.
Yeah.
Every single drama scene feels like they're interchangeable.
Sure.
It's really frustrating, actually.
Your point?
After a while, it's just not interesting. I'm just like, oh, wow, it's the same exact thing again. That's fun.
So here's the thing about Steve Jobs. Yeah. And here's the thing about Aaron Sorkin. Because I'm an Aaron Sorkin super fan.
Yeah.
West Wing's one of my favorite shows of all time. I adore Social Network.
Well,
and I adore Moneyball. And I adore A Few Good Men. And I think he's brilliant. He gets a little samey sometimes.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I am from a family that loves Steven Seagal movies. Okay? I have an aunt and a father that when they grew up, they watched nothing but Steven Seagal movies.
Mm-hmm.
And they love it because it's exactly the same and you just get what you want, and they're fun action movies that you can laugh at. And the thing about Steve Jobs and the thing about Molly's Game, which is coming out this year that I'm sure I will love as well, is that I don't watch them looking for an awards bait character study cerebral drama. I am looking for my version of a Steven Seagal movie, which is fast-paced dialogue that I can laugh at and have a good time with. It gives me sort of the same visceral pleasure that an action movie does for a lot of dudes. And as someone that is not a huge action movie guy, like, I get that same rush when, like, there's a walk and talk in an Aaron Sorkin movie. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
That's why I love Steve Jobs. It's just so much fun for me that way.
It works for, like, half of the movie. But at a certain point when I'm watching it, I'm just like, this just feels exactly the same, and it's just not working on me anymore.
Right.
It's different with, the Social Network, where it's just a more dynamic story in those regards.
Mm-hmm.
It just literally is. And, I mean, I just find all those characters in that movie to be far more compelling. And also you have David Fincher's visual style and palette to elevate everything else, and how he can, you know, use the camera to focus in on certain elements of dialogue, you know,
right,
to emphasize a point, which he's really good at.
It is the perfect combination of writer and director.
Yes.
It really is.
Yes.
There has perhaps never been such a perfect combination in terms of the two of them being, you know, the sum of the two of them being better than their individual parts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that a writer has ever elevated David Fincher's work, or a director has ever elevated Aaron Sorkin's work in the way that the two of them did for each other in that movie.
I agree.
You know?
Which is why A Social Network is... I'm such a Fincher fanboy. And
you
know
really
this.
Are.
But I have tiebreakers for my Fincher films. Sometimes I'm like... Because I just rewatched Zodiac before coming over here, man.
Did you?
I
just listened to a podcast about Zodiac
that
I will send to you because I think you'll really enjoy it.
So good. Sorry, but it's – and then I was going back and forth. I was like, is Social Network better or is this better? I can't figure it out.
Zodiac is such an inherently flawed movie, though. It really is.
I really
it really is.
Because the problem is that flaw that you're talking about, I don't know if it really applies to the Zodiac, because I think the whole point of that movie is saying, like, the Zodiac is nothing special. He's not really about that. It's
right, but then don't take a side on it then. Then, like, don't attempt to solve the crime.
Well, it's funny you say that, because Fincher's cites one of the reasons why the film didn't do well commercially was because there was no closure to the film.
Right.
He's like, yeah, I mean, I learned my lesson with Zodiac, where it's like you can't make a movie that's 2 hours and 40 minutes and have no closure.
Then steer into it more. That's like, if it's – if you really feel like you're not giving closure, then don't even attempt it. The problem is that it's not that they don't give closure, it's that they attempt to give closure and it falls flat. That's the
difference. I think they're just saying, like, here is our take on it based on really what the case evidence was, because I think their point is that it kind of was this guy and it...
I don't care what your take was, though. I really don't.
What's the point of watching a movie?
Well, I'm not interested in what their take is on the crime. I'm not interested in them doing detective work. Yeah. I'm interested in their take on the characters, certainly.
But it's not about the Zodiac. It's about the journalist characters.
Exactly.
That's what the movie's about.
And the truth of the matter is, this guy in all three of those characters, in Ruffalo's case and in Gyllenhaal's case, they were never given closure in real life. So let's not, in a stupid epilogue.
Well, they were, though. This is incredibly factually accurate, though.
Right? I understand. Well, they certainly have a take on what who did it, but they never know for sure. I mean, that's part of the heartbreaking nature of the story.
Yeah. But the whole point of it is that, you know, Zodiac is not Jack the Ripper.
Right.
That he's just this normal guy who is nothing special, really. Sure. He's not really the interesting story in all this. What's interesting are these three characters that were victimized by the Zodiac without the Zodiac ever making physical contact with them.
And they keep coming back. They keep getting drawn back as much as they want to let it go. They can't let it go. And they're just haunted by it.
And that's just the story. I think your criticism is fine, but again, for something like Jack the Ripper, not necessarily the story of the Zodiac.
Sure. I understand.
Because if he was a phantom figure, which is what the movie's saying, is like, guys, he's not a phantom figure. He was just some dumbass who went around killing a bunch of people, and you shouldn't be so obsessed with this. He only killed 5 people.
Right. And there's this great line in the movie where Robert Downey Jr. is like, there were more accidents on the freeway that killed people than he killed.
Yeah, exactly. Because by the end of the movie, I'm not as interested in the Zodiac. I'm more interested in what happened with these people.
Sure. So. Certainly. There is, though, I will send you this podcast. It was on The Ringer. Mm-hmm. This podcast, essentially, they go back and it's called The Rewatchables.
Oh, yeah.
And they just recap the most rewatchable cable movies, mm-hmm. the ones that you just flip on and you're just stuck there for an hour and a half, basically. Yep. And they put Zodiac on this list and they did a whole podcast about Zodiac. And the one scene that they talked about is
basement scene.
Beyond the basement, because the basement scene is the one that gets all of the... Yep. The hype, and it, rightfully so, it is incredibly affecting.
Oh my god!
Yes, but the one scene that they cited, which I used to hate, I really did, and I've come around to it after listening to them talk about it. Mm-hmm. Do you know which one I'm referring to, by any chance?
That you used to hate?
Yes, I used to find it very, oh man, what's the word for it? Very stale. I used to find it very stale.
I don't think anything's stale in the movie.
So
it's not the first scene with Arthur Lee Allen, is it?
No.
Okay.
It's the scene where the couple's having the picnic and the Zodiac comes up.
Oh!
Right. So, yeah.
That is shocking. That is recreated to such a disturbing extent, by the way.
That's what it is. But I remember seeing it for the first time and thinking, man, this is really goofy just because of the lighting and the way that this is framed and everything. But then I go back and I realize that image has never left my brain.
There is something to me. There's just something so strangely eerie about this guy with a black bag over his head, just in the middle of nowhere, in this sort of peaceful environment. You know, just standing
in the middle of the day.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
exactly.
Yes, exactly. It's in the middle of the day when you feel safe and you feel like nothing bad can happen.
And there's no music. It's just this guy just walks up to them. I'm gonna kill you.
Right. Yeah, that was the thing about it.
I love it.
I guess at the time, I didn't appreciate how creepy and effective it was, but it has never left my brain. And now I think about it and I think, oh my God.
That's the quality of a really good film.
That is a movie that really grows with age. For a movie that did not do all that well when it first came out, commercially, critically, whatever.
And people are coming around to say that it could be Fincher's best film.
Yeah.
I could get there in a couple of years. Who knows?
I might get there too. It is a movie and great performances, by the way. Robert Downey Jr. could be the beginning of the Robert Downey Jr. Renaissance.
Technically, it was Gothica.
Fuck you. Go fuck yourself. Go watch your dolphin fucking movie again. Jesus Christ. Go to the aquarium.
I like the aquarium.
I'm sure you do.
I love that aquarium. I love going to see Tilikum.
Jesus Christ.
And And then I jump in and he bites off my genitals and Gothica? I have to sew them back.
Gothica. Unbelievable.
I've never seen Gothica, by the way.
Okay. Good to know. What else do you have on Shape of Water for me? Hit all the points that you want to hit, because I'm just going to keep shitting on it if I keep talking about it.
I love the music.
Yeah.
I love that music. Can you agree with me with that? I thought the music was wonderful.
Yeah, I think the music was good.
Okay, good. Yeah. I got that.
I think it was a good score.
Yeah. Well directed, because I think it's well directed.
I think it is well shot. I think the production design's great. And, you know,
yeah,
it looks pretty. Is that all two direction?
I'm not 100% sure. There's not.
There's more.
There's how you cue your actors, how you block them.
Correct.
How you move the camera in accordance to how the actors are blocked in the scene.
Yeah. How it's paced.
Yep.
Sure. These are all elements that I find a bit flawed, but okay. That's me.
This is it's not really much of an argument here. We're just like, I didn't feel that way.
No, I get you. Really, no, we're not. We're not going to get to a shouting match because we are so diametrically opposed on this. I don't think we're ever going to
meet. Is it just the premise for you?
Yeah. No, it is just the premise for me. And the reason why it's just the premise is because the movie never does anything to justify its premise.
If it justified
the premise, I am there for anything.
All right.
But this movie has to put in the work. That's all. I'm not that guy that's going to rule out the movie on the premise alone. I went and saw it.
Yep.
You know? But, man, it is so goofy. The part at the end with the gills is so ridiculous. So at the end of the movie, essentially, if you have not seen it, clearly this has been a spoiler-filled discussion, and I'm not sure why you're still here. The end of the movie, Sally Hawkins gets shot by Michael Shannon's character, and the fishman, who we have established has magical healing powers, lifts her up. They jump into the river together, and while underwater, he's able to heal her wounds and give her the ability to breathe underwater.
Mm-hmm.
So there are scars on Sally Hawkins' neck, which we are introduced to earlier on in the film, that from some trauma at some point in time caused her to go mute. And I guess we saw this with Nick Evangelista of Why Is This a Thing? And he said essentially that he saw this twist coming from a mile away. I did not see this coming from a mile away. But when they jumped into the river and you see the scars on her neck, I made a joke, sort of like a morbid joke, making fun of this woman's injury. I turn to Nick and I go, she's got gills. And literally 5 seconds later, the dude makes gills out of her neck wounds and she's able to breathe underwater. Absurd, Adam. Absurd. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. That is the one choice when you're in the writer's room, when you're doing punch-up work or whatever, when you bring this to the studio, that's the first note that I sent to Guillermo. We're not giving this woman fish gills, all right? We're just not. We'll give her magical breathing powers underwater. I don't know. We're not giving her gills. So stupid. So stupid.
It was destiny. It was meant to
destiny.
Be.
Destiny! Get the fuck out of here with your destiny!
Clearly, that's what it was. It was meant to be.
There's a fine line. Fine line between, he's so creative, and this dude's a lunatic. And I'm sorry, putting gills on a mute woman so she could breathe underwater with her fish lover, that's crossing the line for me. I'm out. I'm out of the movie at that point. And also, the dancing scene, I'm sure you loved the dancing scene. Did you?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay. The dancing scene is sort of a metaphorical,
Here's the other problem seeing it with you. I'm too conscious of what you're thinking while you're there. Because I'm watching it. I was like, I think this is beautifully staged. It's weird. It's absurd. But it's, oddly, it is kind of beautiful to me.
Yep.
And I think it's from an emotional standpoint, it's working for me. But Nico is just clawing his fucking eyes out right now.
You had a buffer in between me and you.
And it didn't help.
It still didn't help.
Is a bad buffer. Let's admit, okay? Nick Evangelista is a terrible buffer zone, all right?
Because he was turning to us and making comments.
Exactly.
And it was helping me because I was really struggling to get through this piece of shit. But you were very immersed by the ballroom dancing scene in black and white between Sally Hawkins and the fish.
Yep.
It looked absurd. It just looked absurd. I'm all for an old-time Hollywood breakout and dance scene. No question. I love me some tap dancing, too. I was all there for the tap dancing. But God, ridiculous. Just ridiculous, man.
Yep, okay.
Didn't feel it. Richard Jenkins, on the other hand, loved his whole character, loved his arc. I will say the movie at times... How do I want to say this? Gay characters are tough. Gay characters are tough because it feels like Hollywood is just figuring out how to use them.
Okay.
Okay? And, you know, that's, you know, for whatever reason, I think it's great that there are gay characters represented on screen. I'm sure that's a wonderful thing. But it is hard. Here's the implication I didn't like. The fact that a mute woman and an old gay man are in some way kindred spirits to a fish creature. That I just... I'm sorry. That's a problem for me. And I just think these movies have... The intentions are good. But you have to sort of resist the temptation to just define these people as outcasts.
But they are outcasts.
I understand they're outcasts. I understand that's the point of the movie.
It's 1950.
No, I get it. It just feels a bit one-dimensional. It just does. It just feels a little flat and one-dimensional. And for a performance that I really loved, I thought Richard Jenkins was tremendous in this movie, it was not always as subtle as it could have been. You know? Okay. It's just not.
I didn't think he overplayed the gayness.
I don't think he overplayed it. I think that's the nature of the movie, though. Yeah. I think it was just written into a corner. I thought his performance was terrific. Mm-hmm. I think just the way that the movie handles those characters, it feels a little flat to me, and I don't know. I don't know. What it does is it reduces it to just, you know, we are social justice warriors, and our weapon is a fish man, you know, and it's not actually like a full fledged emotional performance, and that takes me out of it sometimes. With the scene in the bar at the pie joint,
yeah,
you know, and that thing happens, and it's very uncomfortable, and I get like the guy is like being racist to the couple that comes in, and it's bothersome, and it makes you feel gross. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel a little taken out of it. I don't know. Just felt a little flat to me.
Okay. It's like, okay, whatever. I didn't really get that.
Okay. All right, fair enough.
It's hard to argue because it's not really a question of like fundamentals or anything like here. There's not I don't know. I think there's a lot, it's hard to break this down technically with us because a lot of what this is sitting on is whether or not you buy into this premise and these characters. Mm-hmm. If you're on board for it, I'm just like, yeah, great. And a lot of it works for me, aside from a few things. And then – very few things. And then for you, you're just like, I don't buy the premise to begin with, and then the whole film falls apart. It's sure. Kind of like my take on Interstellar, where it's just the premise in and of itself is stupid, deliberately stupid. Not deliberately stupid, unintentionally stupid. And Christopher Nolan doesn't know it's stupid.
But there you go, though. But no premise is really stupid if it's executed well, right?
Yes, exactly.
That's the problem with Interstellar. It's not necessarily a stupid premise that people.
It is a stupid premise.
Why?
It's an incredibly stupid premise. The whole premise. Fucking Interstellar. The whole premise revolves around. Okay, Earth is dying.
Right.
Earth is dying, right? Yeah. It's got blight. Okay, so what's your plan? Oh, well, there's a magical wormhole that's opened up at fucking Saturn. Okay, great. Let's go to Saturn and travel through a wormhole that we have no idea would work. First of all, we don't even know if wormholes exist at first, and then we finally find one, and we're like, oh, let's fucking travel through it, because that's a good idea. We have no idea if we would survive. The fate of humanity rests on you spending all this fucking money to get them into this fucking wormhole.
Let's just take a detour to the Matt Damon planet.
Oh, for God's sake. Just you know, just on the chance that it'll win. But hey, you're probably going to die because there's a 90, you know, no, fuck that. There's a 100% chance that you're going to die. And then, oh yeah, we almost forgot. The planets that we want to inhabit are orbiting a black hole. Fuck you. That is the...
See, this is I'm sorry. This is nitpicking. If that movie was not as corny and devoid of all real human emotion as it was, you would have bought it. That's a movie that falls apart because it's badly written and badly directed. That's why. That's all. It's an inventive premise. The idea of wormholes is great.
At that point, because it's just so poorly done, all I can do is nitpick. So
right. I understand that. But it is all execution. I don't think any premise is inherently bad. You just got to execute it well.
Oh, boy.
You know?
Well, no. A premise can be inherently... Yeah, it can be inherently bad. It's just, again, how you tell the story is what's important.
Sure.
That's my take on almost anything. And I do agree. The problem with that movie is just that the storytelling's absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
It just doesn't help that every single fucking scene is just... It's just bad. I'm just sorry, but from a literal standpoint, it doesn't make any sense. And then I'm sitting there at the end of it, I was like, okay, movie... If these fifth dimensional god beings were setting up all the pieces so that destiny would present itself in Jesus Christ in the form of fucking what the hell's his name, Matthew McConaughey would do his thing, you know, Joseph Cooper, oh my God, JC, that's so
Coop,
JC, those are his initials, that's so creative. Anyway,
Murph,
oh my God, and if these fifth dimensional beings have the physical capabilities to open up a wormhole and place a tesseract inside of a black hole. Why the fuck can't they stop the blight on Earth? It's just the dumbest thing.
You're getting a bit nerdy.
I'm sorry. It's just so bad. Why would you try to stop at a planet orbiting a black hole? That doesn't make any sense. Do you have any idea how destructive and dangerous black holes are? Any NASA engineer would be like, oh, okay, well, I mean, we're not actually going to go inhabit a planet, but let's just indulge for a second. Let's see what's actually going on in this galaxy. What's the big indicator number one? What do we have to deal with? Oh, there's a black hole 100 feet away from this planet. No. 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 All right,
Neil
no,
deGrasse Tyson.
No. 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 No.
Oh, God.
That movie is so stupid. Oh, I'm sorry. Goodness. Ugh.
I hate when you get on your soapbox.
I fucking hate Interstellar.
I understand.
Oh, that movie.
All right, so just take that, like, divide it by three.
Yeah.
Find the square root of whatever that is. And that's how I felt about Shape of Water.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
And maybe that's the way that you could find empathy to exactly how I was feeling during that stupid fucking movie we watched yesterday.
I don't know if that's terrible. So you have, like, so your feelings towards Shape of Water about times two are my feelings for, like, Dunkirk. So that's good.
Sure.
There we go.
There you go.
We got to mathematically break
this down.
Look
at this. Look at this. We're really bridging the gap here. It's
all making sense now.
It is. It's all coming together. And I will enjoy even more when we debate the merits of these films, specifically being Dunkirk and The Shape of Water, in our upcoming.
We're gonna debate those two.
Review. And maybe not.
I don't want to. I don't want to talk about Dunkirk. The more I think about Dunkirk, the more, like, it makes me upset to think about that movie. Mm-hmm. It really does.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got a sneak peek at your list on Twitter.
Yeah.
That list might change between now and...
It almost certainly will.
In the upcoming podcast, which we're going to aim for next week, but no promises.
I'm sorry about the disaster. It's probably going to get knocked off that list.
I think so, too. Currently, it's on mine, and I think
I was thinking about it, and it's like, I may actually, like, Planet of the Apes more. I thought about that. And I like Guardians more.
Yeah.
Guardians 2.
Okay.
So I was thinking about it. I was like, yeah, I got to update that.
So that might make the cut. So I saw your sneak preview.
Yeah.
And my list is remarkably different.
I know.
So I'm actually really excited because I think it's going to give us a really interesting look at our two film tastes.
Yeah.
And we're really going to get a good sense of where we fall on that whole front. So we're going to do our end of the year top 10 lists. Counting them down, and I think I'm going to throw in a couple little twists to make it a little more fun because everybody's doing top 10 lists, and you know, people have had enough of them. You know, everybody, we get it. Ranking things.
Yeah, no. My biggest twist is he does a top 11.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. You do a top 11.
I do a top 11. That's right. Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Yeah, that'll be really fun. So that'll be coming up in the near. Oh! Before we go, can we talk Ridley Scott, please?
Yes.
Can we talk about Ridley Scott?
Yes, we can talk Ridley. Oh, I'd love to.
So Ridley Scott has went crazy.
On Blade Runner. Oh, it was wonderful.
On Blade Runner 2049.
This was good.
This dude is going nuts in press interviews. Like, this dude is apparently, like, crazy Ridley Scott interviews are all the rage these days. Like, those, that's what's in style now.
You need to see the Beavis and Butthead one.
Okay.
I swear he's got to be, like, drinking more at this point in his life. I don't know, but he's – I saw one where he was doing something about Alien Covenant. I swear to God, he was just toasted.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
So this guy is just like, I don't give a fuck. I feel, sunglasses, thug life.
I feel bad. He directed potentially my favorite movie.
Don't feel bad. Ridley's having a good time.
He's an egotistical motherfucker.
Listen, whew. These guys get old. Let them be old. Old's a great thing.
This guy ranked two of his films as the best science fiction films ever made. And I agree with him, but Jesus, if I were a filmmaker, I would never do that.
You know, it's certainly true, though. Of course.
Jesus Christ.
No, I understand he's an egomaniac. But now he gets to be an old egomaniac, and he gets to just shit on things without any fear of consequence.
Yeah.
So this interview, which was, I think, like, was it Vulture? Yes.
Something like that.
One of those random entertainment blogs asked him about Blade Runner 2049. After asking him about all the money in the world and all of the crazy reshoots that they did on that.
They asked him about David Fincher, too. They said, yeah, he overdoes it. He shoots things too much and exhausts the actors. I don't like that. Yeah, okay, dude.
Yeah, but that's like David Fincher's thing, though, right? That's
My first thought was like, I thought you were a fan of Stanley Kubrick.
Right, exactly. Just emotional trauma.
Yeah, okay, whatever.
So they ask him about Blade Runner, and first he's like, yeah, I helped out a lot with the script, and they didn't really give me any credit, but a lot of this was my story. And also, that movie's way too fucking long. And that's the exact quote.
Yeah, I know.
That movie is way too fucking long. And I immediately sent it to you because I felt so much joy knowing that the visionary behind the original Blade Runner, which is a movie that you love, you adore that movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't like it. But this guy, in a moment of profound clarity, pinpointed exactly what was wrong with the new Blade Runner, which is like that movie is longer than like most HBO miniseries now. You know, like I could watch Band of Brothers quicker than I could watch this. You know,
it was a funny interview. I read that actually before, though. I was like, I wasn't surprised though, because like I was texting you about this, and I'm sort of shaking my head. It's like, yeah, that figures. I had a feeling he said that. Here's the thing. He is in love, like Ridley Scott is in love with his own Blade Runner to the point where he gets like depressed talking about it because he wanted the movie to do so well, just so badly.
Well, he devoted like 30 years of his life to making sure the definitive version of it came out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So to me, I'm just literally my reaction to that was like, yeah, you wanted 2049 to do really well, didn't you?
Right.
You wanted it to do so well. Now, don't worry, Ridley Scott. People know of your movie, and I think it's cemented itself in film history and iconography.
Certain nerds.
Yes. No. Iconography.
We've had this argument already, but fair enough.
I'm sorry, but it created a whole subgenre of science fiction.
Okay.
That George Lucas stole from. Okay. And when George Lucas steals from it and puts it in Star Wars, I'm pretty sure it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And Attack of the Clones, unfortunately. I think he desperately wanted this one to be like a smashing hit at this point.
So you think it's just Monday morning quarterback, this movie didn't do as well as I wanted it to do, so let's find a reason why.
Yes.
You don't think he legitimately thought that it was too long?
He made Kingdom of Heaven. No, I don't think he actually thinks that, Nico. Have you seen Kingdom of Heaven?
I haven't.
Holy it's got its moments, but whoa, that movie is a slog even for me.
Fair enough. Touche. Okay. All I know is that in this particular instance, Ridley Scott stumbled on the truth somehow. So I'm happy with that. Good on you, old
like,
man.
And I'm like, really, it doesn't matter. That
good on you, old man. It
doesn't matter one little
bit
to me.
Let's just trim up that second act, and we'll be we'll just cruise here. Okay. Anyway, that's a podcast. How about that?
Yeah.
Where can people find your film takes online?
At some Adam Hall.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm at Funny Nico Tweets.
Yummy.
Happy New Year. Merry Christmas. Hope your all Christmases were good. You know, hope everybody enjoyed that. We'll be back next week with some end of the year goodness, talking about more movies. All right?
Yeah.
So how about it, dude? How about you close us out here?
Happy movie hopping.
Happy movie hopping.